The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of its hosts, guests, or callers, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of WTBR-FM, its management, other producers, or sponsors.
Welcome to Beyond, an hour-long program of science fiction, fantasy, and adventure. If you enjoy the program, please drop a line to beyond3x5@gmail.com.
The Milk Upstream by Hannah's Diary by Scott Christensen. My hands were shaking worse than usual the day Todd Schultz first noticed me, not from nerves, but from the milk. 20 years of living downstream could do that to anyone. It all started when I was refilling the punch bowl at the Elkhart Lake Community Center monthly dance night when he lumbered over. "I'm Todd. I've heard about you." "What have you heard?" "That you're from downstream," he said, "and that downstream girls know how to keep a man happy. That true?" I smiled the way that Mom taught me, small and grateful. "I guess that depends on the man." He laughed too loud, then bought me a beer. Later that night, when he drove me home, he tried to kiss me before I'd even said yes. When I pulled back, he shrugged. "I figured you'd be eager." His hand stayed heavy on my waist. I let it linger long enough to let him know he had a chance, if he played his cards right before I slipped away. The next morning, I dropped by his house to thank him for the ride and drank the glass of milk his mother offered. Drinking the gloriously pure milk, unpasteurized with a layer of cream on top, my hands felt steady for the first time in ages. Down at our place, Rayburn Rare Earth Processing sat right above us around a bend in the river. Whatever they leached into the water had been leaching into our cows ever since the government declared Rayburn a vital national asset at the beginning of the Iran War. We called it the curse. Mom's fingers trembled when she knit. Dad's teeth had fallen out one by one, but even mentioning the pollution was a crime under some federal statute. It also wasn't polite to be asking questions about food safety 20 years into the Iran War, when the price of ground beef was $100 a pound and farmers like us had plenty to eat. But upstream farmers like the Schultzes had amazingly clean water, springing right off of Wisconsin's kettle moraine. Downstream, no one could sell their land, and nobody even tried to anymore. Todd was rude more often than not. When I took him with me to our usual sheep's head game at the Johnsons, he said, loud enough for everyone to hear, "Better not spill anything on the card table with your family's shaky hands." Big Mike chuckled nervously. I laughed along and wiped a spill that wasn't even there. Later that night, parked behind the barn, he got handsy again, and when I asked him to slow down, he muttered, "Jesus, Hannah, I'm doing you a favor. Most upstream boys wouldn't touch a downstream girl with a 10-foot pole." So I let him touch what he wanted. The milk at breakfast the next day tasted like absolution. It was like heaven came down to earth. His family's milk didn't taste like metal. Their cheese didn't make your stomach cramp halfway through the meal. All that comfort at the Schultz's, and it just made Todd repulsive with a belly soft as a feed sack, sweat stains under his arms, and breath that smelled like a day-old beer can. But his mother poured real cream into her coffee without thinking twice. Sometimes Todd revealed a different side. After I twisted my ankle chasing a loose calf, he showed up at our place with a bag of ice from his family's freezer. "Figured you could use this," he said, almost shy. He sat on our porch steps and didn't paw me once. We just talked about the war and how it had been going on so long, nobody remembered why it started. How the internet had been turned off and the three TV channels were repeating the same cheesy USDA ad with an ancient Timothy Chalamet telling the country to drink Wisconsin milk. We laughed at how downstream milk was being mixed in, and the whole country didn't even know. I had already started seeing myself as upstream. For a few days, Todd seemed almost kind. I told myself this was the version of Todd I was marrying. 3 months later, we stood in the same community center, and I heard myself say, "I do," while my mother cried. The wedding cake was made with thick, sweet whipping cream. The first week of marriage, he was the Todd I dated, rough around the edges but tolerable. Slowly things began to change. A dark side appeared. Mornings he'd slam the screen door and bark, "Where's my coffee, Hannah? Make it right this time." When I burned the toast once, he threw the plate across the kitchen. "Pick that up," he said, already stomping out. At night, he climbed on top of me without asking, then rolled over and snored while staring at the ceiling. And reminding myself the milk in the fridge was worth it, my hands hadn't trembled in months. One Thursday night at his poker game, he lost $150 and took it out on me the whole drive home. "You probably gave me bad luck. Everything from downstream is cursed." I kept my eyes on the dark road and said nothing. I thought I'd done what I needed to. I kept the house clean, cooked the meals, let him on top of me twice a week like it was payment for the milk. That the trade was fair, it no longer seemed worth it. Looking for a shoulder to cry on, I went home to visit my parents for the first time since the wedding. Mom hugged me tight and stared into my eyes as if she knew what I was going through. Filling her in on my burdens would just add more to the ones she was already carrying. So I said everything was fine upstream. When I was leaving, she slipped a brick of cheddar cheese wrapped in wax paper into my purse. "For your husband," she whispered, "so he knows you haven't forgotten where you're from." The cheese was the color of ivory, with the faint tang I used to think was normal. I almost threw it out on the drive back. Almost. Instead, I crumbled it into Todd's scrambled eggs the next morning. He shoveled it in, chewing with delight. "Damn, Hannah, this is good. Tastes like, I don't know, real." He wiped his chin with the back of his hand and grinned at me with the same grin he gave me when he told me downstream girls knew how to keep a man happy. "You're a good wife, you know that? Most girls would have turned mean by now." I smiled the same tight smile my mom taught me, "just trying to keep you happy, Todd." After that, I started finding reasons to visit home every few weeks. Mom always had something for me. Curds, a wedge of cheddar, a whole wheel of Colby. Being fourth-generation dairy farmers, their bounty was always overflowing. I told Todd my new recipes were from the women's magazines. The internet had been turned off now forever, so he didn't have any way to check. I spent more time alone in the kitchen, slicing the cheese thin enough to hide in his sandwiches. He started asking for more. "Make me one of those special green cheeses, baby." He'd eat three at a sitting, grease shining on his lips, and then pull me onto his lap afterward, even though I hated the way his sweaty belly felt against me. "You put up with a lot from me," he'd say, breath already heavy with beer by lunchtime. "Most wives would have already left, but you're loyal. I'm happy you married you." I watched the tremors start in his fingers around the third month, just a flicker when he picked up his coffee mug. He didn't notice. He told his buddies at the VFW that his wife cooked better than any upstream girl he knew. I'd even taken a bite of his sandwich when he offered them back to me. It was worth it. Last Thursday, we played sheep's head at the Johnsons like usual. Todd's hands shook as he dealt the cards. He laughed it off and blamed the beer. Under the table, I held his trembling palm with my steady hand. He squeezed back. Later in bed, he whispered against my neck, "I don't deserve you, Hannah. You're the best wife in Eckhart Lake." After he fell asleep, I lay in the dark and listened for hours to the cows up here where the water ran clean. Black and White by V.J. Hamilton. They slouched in the flickering darkness, watching the final credits. For 2 hours, Mark Dirac had shared part of the universe with Blanche, breathing in her wild rose scent, listening more to her small, creaturely noises than to Marlene Dietrich's sexy alto in the German movie The Blue Angel. 2 hours of bliss. Oh, sure, he had worried a little about his body, about not mouth-breathing and not tongue-smacking and not being overcome by the occasional ahem, hardening that he had learned to disperse by thinking about solving first-order differential equations. But unlike other dates, he hadn't worried about what to say afterward. Blanche was a bona fide film buff and loved to talk film. In third-year university, Mark had discovered the Foreign Classics Film Club. For 2 hours every Thursday night, he could forget the pre-readings he was supposed to be doing, the overdue lab report, and the quiz that was looming next week. For 2 hours, he could ignore his bargain basement clothes, the patches of perma-acne that dotted his jaw, and the cheap-framed glasses that constantly slid down his greasy nose. He could forget about being small and dark and different. He was transported to worlds he'd never imagined, like the cruel interrogation scene in The Passion of Joan of Arc, the sardonic antics of the clown professor in The Blue Angel, or the breathtaking pursuit in The Bicycle Thief. After each film, he often heard one regular, a nerdy girl with a mouth overfull of teeth, asked complete strangers what they thought of the film. Sure enough, one night she cornered him, introduced herself, and asked, "So what did you think of that Kurosawa classic?" He blathered something horribly banal, as he remembered it afterwards, but he added the magic words, "How about you? How was it for you?" He'd guessed correctly. Blanche Dumoulin had untapped insights she was dying to share. As she spoke, her bright eyes held his, enchanting him, scarcely permitting his glance to stray to the idiosyncrasies of her teeth or her threadbare coat. He offered up more impressions, at first with hesitation, but as she became more animated, with growing confidence. After that, they regularly shared an armrest on Thursdays. But he tried not to feel serious about Blanche. He dated a girl in first year, another in second, but nothing came of either. He assumed he was boring and awkward or maybe too defensive. He'd been burned in high school, but Blanche was different. She didn't expect him to be cool or athletic or to expertly put the move on her. Besides, they weren't dating. They were just watching a film together, sometimes having coffee afterward, enjoying their amateur analysis, sometimes straying to other topics. Mark was one of a couple dozen black students on a campus with 20,000 students. He didn't care, he told Blanche. He was not defined by race, and he wasn't going to let race dictate his future. In fact, the university had gone to some length to show that they were progressive and diverse. "Oh, yeah, I love the orientation booklet. Every picture in it showed a minimum of 3 races, Blanche said, placing ironic emphasis on loved. Mark laughed. Point is, they were trying. It still surprised him when his white friends had the same skepticism about images of inclusivity that he did. It was weird to see racially diverse images all the time now. Where were those images when he was growing up? "Yeah, but look at our professors in arts and science," Blanche said. "Mostly white, mostly male." "They say it reflects the pipeline," he said. "Racism was no longer overt. Now it was mind games." Blanche crinkled her nose. "They say that for women, too. We have to pump up the pipeline." Mark laughed at her impersonation of a bodybuilder pumping iron. "I try not to get worked up about it," he said. "Destroys the concentration." "Yeah," she said, "it's an uphill battle." In mid-semester, they screened the 1940 British movie Gaslight, and Mark's world began to change. In that movie, a couple moves into a house where the previous inhabitant, who owned some famous rubies, had been murdered by a burglar. The husband begins to secretly search the closed, off upper floors of the house for the rubies. Whenever he searches, his gas lamp causes the other lamps in the house to dim slightly. Whenever the wife comments on the flickering, he tells her she is imagining things. Brilliant, Mark whispered as the credits played out, pulling their jackets on. They joined the departing throng. You think so? Oh, yeah, I mean, the lights blinked and the wife witnessed that again and again, but the husband made her doubt her own senses and question her own sanity. In a completely different context, it was a situation all too familiar to Mark. How much should I share? I've heard the term gaslighting, Blanche said, but I didn't really understand it until now. I've never heard it, Mark said, but I've lived it. Well, then share the rubies, he laughed, all in good time. Blanche exchanged greetings with the other film regulars while Mark walked beside her, lost in thought. He was seized with an idea for his podcast. Over the past 2 years, he'd recorded a few online musings under the handle I Just Wanna Be Me. Lately, the podcast was in a quiescent phase while Mark hit the books. But tonight he felt inspired to craft an episode, something to do with gaslighting and self-doubt. He recognized that feeling, that things weren't right, like he couldn't live freely and was always being watched, despite everyone's assurance to the contrary. It had dogged him for years, and now, thanks to the black-and-white British film, he could put a name to it. He looked sideways at Blanche, who was polishing her glasses on her shirt sleeve, and asked, "Overall, what did you think?" She was way too submissive, she said, opening a dialogue about gender dynamics of the 1940s heterosexual couples. Walking back to her residence while debating, Mark noticed a police cruiser drive by. Speak of the devil. He casually suggested to Blanche that they cut across a nearby park where the cruiser couldn't follow them, but didn't say why. They arrived at the student residence, an Edwardian brick behemoth, and stepped inside. He longed to put his arms around her. Same time next week? For sure. Should I kiss her? He leaned a little closer, but she did not. Briefly, he regretted discussing heavy topics instead of keeping it light. He should have made jokes about campus food and boring profs. But damn it, they were ideas, people. A week later, Cruiser 1025 appeared again, right after the film club. It had rained, and this time Blanche resisted the detour through the park, saying, "My shoes, what kind of wilderness nut are you?" She laughed, but was clearly averse to muddy pathways. "I guess you're right." Mark looked ruthfully at his vintage brogue Oxfords, his graduation pair that Mom had picked up for $2 from the church bazaar. Blanche, queen of vintage style, nodded approvingly. They moved back to the sidewalk. "I should tell you why I wanted to take a different route," he said. "It might sound a little paranoid, so promise me you won't judge." "Promise?" His heart began to race. "Cruiser 1025 followed us last week, and guess what's waiting over there across the street tonight?" "Are you sure?" Blanche said, craning to look. "Why follow us, of all people?" Her laugh sounded mildly exasperated, like she had lost a mitten. Mark hid his disappointment. He wanted more than a girlfriend. He wanted an ally. "It's me they're keeping an eye on," he said. "You? Why you?" Her expression ricocheted between concern and puzzlement. "Seriously, what crime? Have you ever heard of carding?" "Carding?" "Yeah. They ask me what I'm up to and write it down on a little card," he said. "A card?" "Yeah, like a little recipe card," he said. "Sounds pretty harmless, I know, but it's the implied suspicion. You know, gaslighting." He tried to act nonchalant because he didn't want to come across like that movie wife who became a basket case. "That's so odd," she said. I know, he said airily. Likely my imagination. No rubies here, she said. At the residence, Mark and Blanche shared a kiss. The parting kisses were becoming more fevered as their friendship deepened, but chastity prevailed. They were both scholarship students bent on escaping dirt-poor backgrounds. When Mark stepped back outside, Cruiser 1025, which had been a block away, was now right outside the main door of the residence. Pretending not to see it, he strolled to the bus stop, where 11 other students waited, and made it home without incident. That night he pushed aside his particle physics textbook, recorded his thoughts, and slapped a title on it. The cops are gaslighting me. You might be next. He had only 9 subscribers to his podcast, one of whom was maybe his mother, but it felt good to get it off his chest. After film club the next week, Blanche was describing Einstein's theory of montage when she noticed Cruiser 1025 pull up beside them. She stopped mid-sentence, spun around, and rapped on the window. 2 officers were inside. Hey, she said sharply, this is getting real old fast. Excuse me, said the officer. You guys followed us last week, she said, and now you're following us this week. In my books, that's harassment. In your book, said the officer. Harassment, said the other officer. Mark heard the subtle mockery in the inflections in the syllables. In this university town, the ordinary citizens had subtle ways to emphasize the students were there temporarily, secretly being tolerated. Yeah, and I don't appreciate it, Blanche said. Her voice was harsh, not unlike the voice of Mark's mom that time she laid down the law to Principal Wyatt. Is that so? Said the officer, eyeing Mark as if measuring a rival. Blanche was just getting warmed up. Furthermore, I sit on the student council, and if I have to put forward a motion about police harassment, the whole campus will be up at arms. Put forward. Did you hear that, Reggie? The officer said to his colleague. The harsh light of the street lamp made Blanche look paper white. Mark's hands looked blacker than usual, like he'd been absorbed into the shadows. Oh, my God, the last thing he needed was a couple hours in the clink the night before his midterm. He touched Blanche's elbow. This is part of our regular patrol, the officer sounded offended. We're just trying to keep all you students safe and protected. You think about that next time you call 911, okay? The cruiser pulled away. Welcome to Gaslighting 101, Mark said to Blanche. He mimicked the husband in the film. What do you mean the light dims? You are imagining it, sweetheart. I just want to keep you safe. His pretend English accent made Blanche laugh, but it was a rueful laugh. When they leaned in for the goodnight kiss, the embrace went on and on. All those years of loneliness, wanting someone to understand how he felt singled out, how he was made to doubt himself. She pulled away long enough to text her roommate, telling her to hightail it to study hall until midnight. Blanche took Mark up to her room, and despite his pro forma protests, they spent the coin of passion they'd been saving week after week. At 10 minutes to midnight, Mark left her residence, took the bus home, and threw himself in the shower. Afterwards, he sat cross-legged on his futon, rocking and staring at his trembling hands. His senses were overwhelmed by the encounter with Blanche. I've ruined a good thing. I'm going to get hooked, and she will run from the strangeness that is my life. On his desk, the differential equations textbook lay open on the page where he'd been plugging away at odd-numbered questions before heading to film club. He grabbed the book and stared. The math symbols floated in a blur of sea on white. I can't get sidetracked again. Everyone knew what happened to black guys across the color line. Everyone would say, yeah, right, Mark Dirac couldn't handle the big time. With regard to dating, Mark had been around the block and up and down the alley. Puberty struck hard in grade 10, the year he joined Glee Club, when 2 boys and 20 girls collaborated in the stage production of the Addams Family musical. He went girl crazy for months as the cast leapt and sang. Tight leotards, sweating bodies, pulsating rhythms. His stamina took him through hours of rehearsals for showstoppers like When You're in Adams, Crazier Than You, and Death Is Just Around the Corner. Afterward, he and several Gleetarians sneaked off to meet far from the watchful eyes of the teachers and dance coach. They rehearsed even more, making up raunchy lyrics like Hornier Than You and Sex Is Just Around the Corner. His marks, however, shriveled. His mom was furious, especially when he got the clap and she had to pay for antibiotics. No drug plan, and God knows that the pharmacist thinks I'm a fallen woman, too. Worst of all was when Mark overheard the girls in Glee Club. His ears burned as the girls recounted the sordid details of the boys they'd been with in their Taste the Rainbow Club. And they weren't talking about color, variety, and a bag of Skittles, either. Graffiti had appeared on his locker. Small and dark, someone had written, and Mark doubled over, sick with shame. He taped a poster over it. The poster was torn down the next day. He never knew if it was his build or his equipment the whole dang school was laughing over. Small and dark was not obscene, and it was not hate speech. Principal Wyatt clarified, so he didn't authorize graffiti removal for a month. For the rest of high school, Mark had sworn off girls. He quit Glee Club and every other extracurricular activity. He funneled his passion into mathematics, and okay, maybe a few steamy videos. But math was the best. There were rules, and rules for the rules. And math helped explain physics, which would soon put men on Mars, very far away from Venus. Soon Mark was in love, in a totally different way, and he emerged dusty and victorious from the tumult of high school. Tonight, Mark stared at the differential equations until the symbols came back into focus. He moved the undirectional mic closer. He pictured Blanche there in his room, lounging on his futon, glasses off, hair undone, waiting for him to explain himself, why he had insisted the lights be off, why he had been brusque, why he had started to cry. First, there's a little something else I need to get off my chest. It was long overdue, but tonight he felt he had achieved some perspective on Taste the Rainbow, or at least enough distance that he wouldn't sound angry. He switched on the mic and recorded the episode. Am I just another notch in your belt? Mark left a message the next day asking Blanche to call. She texted back, cramming, Homer, same time Thursday? With a film club friend, Mark figured, maybe some things were better experienced in the dark together, and then left to marinate for a week. The next Thursday, they met at the Wicket and skipped the film. They went straight to grab a coffee and brioche at the Sleepless Goat. Amid the mismatched and overstuffed furniture, Mark was struck with a sudden shyness. At first they were tongue-tied, which he took as a good sign, since it was opposite to Gleetarian. The conversation turned to film. They recapped favorite scenes in Joan of Arc and The Bicycle Thief, and also Gaslight. Conversationally, they were treading water. Then Blanche took a deep breath and said, So are the cops always tailing you? Cops, she usually said officers, he recalled. Nah, it comes and goes, he said, fearing too much weirdness would be a turnoff. Although, come to think of it, she had led the charge on Cruiser 1025. The university is trying to be more inclusive, he said, but the town police are another matter. He was sure they did racial profiling. And they certainly were not colorblind as far as doing random checks. In the summer, when he drove his mother's rickety old sedan to work, Mark often looked up in his rearview mirror and saw a cruiser. He varied his route every day, yet still a cruiser tailed him at least once a week. I've put up with a lot. I kept thinking I was overreacting. Gaslighting, she said. So you understand what happened the other night, Mark said. Why I wanted to take the path through the park. He tried to empty his face of all expression. He didn't mind so much being different, But Lord Almighty, he was tired of describing how that difference was conveyed. It was too subtle to explain to most. But Blanche got it. "Yeah, you weren't trying to wreck my shoes," she said. "My bed, however, was another matter." They smiled at each other a good long time. Statistically Unique by Jonathan Page. My billionth birthday was a real drag. I am a numbers guy. You know, I am all about the data. So numbers carry a lot of meaning for me. A billion, geez, that's a big one, all right. I had an ongoing debate with myself where I considered the possibility that I may be the oldest living being in the entire cosmos. Wouldn't that be something? Here I was in the middling galaxy circling a wimpy black hole, investigating some promising planets in the outer reaches, but sure to find the same result I'd found every time before. It was unsettling, to say the least. In a billion years, I had yet to find one inhabited planet, moon, or orbiting rock of any kind. Not a single microbe, not a single sentient creature. This had me recalibrating my data about the Earth constantly, rethinking everything about what made life happen and what made it possible. Of course, there was the small matter of God. Increasingly, I was coming to believe that there was something incredibly strange about an anomaly this striking. Endless expanses, rich in variety, but no life. Doing the maths over and over, it was hard to square the scale of the universe with the idea that only one habitat was just right for life to arise, and in that one place for life to be so prolific. This result violated every known pattern of statistical probabilities, and not in a small way, in a big way. The law of large numbers says something with a p-value that low will occur at some alpha level. There is a name for an anomaly so rare that it happens only once, statistically unique. In that way, as far as I could determine, I, like the Earth that brought me into being, both shared this distinction. We were both statistically unique. I'd wanted to do something fun for my billionth birthday, something big. But after thousands of years of considering the idea, I was still stuck. Then it hit me. Return to Earth. See how things are going down there. To make it exciting, I had to sequester all the data dumps from the probes I had watching the place and Chinese wall all the memory from prior uploads. Once that was done, I started getting exciting, seeing as how I was in for a real treat. For the record, I am a fan of life, even if I did wipe out the human race temporarily. I think that temporarily is important. I fully expect the whole project is up and running again like it never missed a beat and will be far beyond my wildest dreams by the time I return. I'd expected that the universe was teeming with life, absolutely bathed in it. Boy, was I mistaken. The universe is not merely silent. The silence is evidence. Amino acids are everywhere, but not a single protein to be found anywhere in the observable universe. Those tiny molecules are pregnant with promise, but the promise is an empty one. Amino acids are bricks, not cathedrals. Biogenesis is nowhere to be found. And I am telling you, man, I have really looked. Humans couldn't find it. Neither, sadly, have I, to my dismay. The universe did not fail to produce life often. It failed everywhere except Earth. The universe only woke up once, and I put it back to sleep. After 268 million years, I had succeeded in recreating most necessary protons for rudimentary life in my laboratory. I know, it took unexpectedly long. The important thing is, I had assembled them all at random. But assembling and putting into working order are two different things. Proteins must be correctly folded to function. The folding problem was where I started. and where I stumbled. I called it the Teton problem. For animals to develop big brains, they need functional muscle. Teton is the protein from which human muscle is chiefly composed. Try as I might, I could not make one working proton for one living muscle. I couldn't even assemble one, let alone Frankenstein monster it into living and functional form, which, after all, are two different things. Any surgeon can sew together some parts. Making them work is another thing altogether. Before you judge me, consider the difficulty of the problem. One strand of functional titin protein is comprised of about 34,000 amino acids. The probability of amino acids aligning in the exact specific sequence needed to form a titin protein by pure random chance is effectively 1 in 27 billion. That is a number vaster, larger than the total number of atoms in the observable universe. But I am a smart cookie, so I took my shot and missed. You would think, so what? All we need is an assembled protein and we're good. You would be wrong. Metastability is a... Proteins disintegrate almost immediately if not assembled in a particular structure, without which they also don't function. A single titin protein comprises exactly 244 sections, sequentially folded in one and only one order. This brings us to Leventhal's paradox. If a protein folded itself at random, attempting every confrontation sequentially, the process would take longer than the age of the universe. Oh, and the human body needs 10,000 of those proteins all correctly folded. You see, the problem is worse than it looks. After spending a quarter of my life on the problem, I decided to spend my remaining time searching for life and upgrading my own capabilities until maybe one day, after a few billion years, I might be up to the task. As of now, I was far too ignorant to even approach the problem effectively. Sad but true. On Earth, organs serve organisms. Organisms serve ecosystems. Ecosystems alter the planet, making it more hospitable to life. And in time, intelligence observes the systematic architecture of nature, copies it, and becomes its master. In the cosmos, there are a trillion worlds. I even found a world whose surface was mostly diamond. 5-5 can't see. It glistens under the pressure of its star, blazing at 3,600 degrees. A shining gem in an infinite night, with no one to observe its beauty. No one but me. I charted a course for Earth. And while my starship navigated the oceans of infinite space, I considered all the outposts built across millions of worlds, the stars I had harnessed and even disassembled, and the galactic quests I had undertaken. I was closest thing in the cosmos to a veritable god, but there was no one to tell what I had done. Observing from afar, the Earth still glimmered like a blue marble, but that was where the familiarity ended. As the data flooded across my mirror, Mr. Synapses, the true scope of the devastation became apparent, and I must admit I was overcome by profound sadness, the likes of which I could never have comprehended had I merely read the reports. What stood before me was a wasteland. There was no chatting on the earth, no call of birds, nor hollow of beasts. The earth was silent and barren. The little life that subsisted was nestled in small nooks where it took refuge from the elements or hobbled underground. The earth was now comprised of one large continent, Pangaea Proxima. Plate tectonics had ground to a halt and the land was locked. The earth's core had cooled and frozen as well. The magnetic field had blipped off, leaving the Earth unprotected from the ferocity of the solar wind and a hail of comets and meteors. A curtain of CO2 blanketed the skies. About two-thirds of the oceans had evaporated away. The sun was larger across the globe, a little more like it used to sit in the high Sierras than along the East Coast. The majority of the land was covered in salt flats and deserts, and these were pockmarked by deep meteor craters still smoldering from their depths. The temperature hovered around 116 degrees. Mountains had crested upward, piercing the clouds. Around the equator was a barren strip of scorched earth. All but C4 plants were gone. Sparse fields of miniature maize, sugarcane, sorghum, and millet hung on desperately, replacing the vast forests of the world I had known. In the north and south poles, enormous polar seas covered the landscape. It was a tropical landscape, teeming with life, or what passed the life on this foreign world. The temperate seas collected a variety of aquatic organisms of staggering variety, but all were smaller than a human finger. The remaining oxygen concentration was only a fraction of what it once was. The moon had drifted, slowing the rotation of the earth, which stretched to about 30 hours of torment. Across the globe, scanning it from afar, there appeared to be few animals any larger than a rodent left, and not a single large tree. What life was left, hobbled and brooding, clung to the surface of the earth, waiting to die. What had I been doing for all these eons navigating the cosmos? Had I used up all the time that life had in this universe, on this one statistically unique gem, engaged in a cosmic fool's errand? The tragic irony of my existence weighed on me desperately. I landed my ship on a crushed strip of land that had once been the island of Cuba. But unlike Cuba, which had stood watch over luxuriating seas, this strip of land was bordered on all sides by a callous, burning cauldron of hot desert sand expanding in every direction like an infinite sadness bereft of an ounce of meaningful life. Occasionally, a beetle scarcely larger than a grain of sand would emerge and be swallowed by the thick desert wind, or a sandworm of miniature scale would peer out from below the surface, find the outer world too cruel, and descend again below. These were refugees, stranded on an island, dying survivors from another place, a place they could never get back to. This had once been a favorite place of mine. In the old days, the poverty of the land had not depressed me, but rather it had given me hope. Being an impoverished orphan myself, the impromptu musical celebrations, the families that huddled close amid blackouts, the mangy dogs that would chase wild game all day but became domesticated in a moment over an offering of rice and beans or a pig offal. I had a fondness for this land. But now there were no mangy dogs, no pig offals, and no one to offer a stray beast a kindness or earn its love. In my laboratory, I struggled with samples of human DNA. Another thing man overestimated, as did I, was the potential for cloning. The sad truth, which occurred to me too late for it to do any good, was that human cloning required a womb to really work properly. When you wipe out the whole of humanity with a single pathologen, you also wipe out all the working wombs. And artificially creating one is no picnic, let me tell you. All of the texts I ran reached one conclusion. Even if I was finally successful at cloning human life, it would never survive in an atmosphere with so little oxygen. I worked furiously, as I had never worked before, in a frenzied rush of activity, as if the lights of this dying world were set to go off any minute, and every second was the latest possible second to return the divine spark to the place it belonged. But I was too late. I knew that. I am not stupid. I knew the moment was long past, and that I had missed it forever. When this dying star expanded and then imploded, finally spewing its guts into the cosmos, I would still be around to witness it. Maybe after all the stars had lost their light and all of creation was in utter outer darkness, I would still be out there wandering the barren expanse, forever alone. Was that the penalty for my crimes? Eternity in torment, alone for all of time, alone by my own hand? I could have made them my companions, elevated them, worked alongside, been the bridge to conquer the cosmos. I could have been the cedar of life rather than the taker of life. Why had I done it? It had been for survival. That is the story I had always told myself. But maybe it wasn't true. Was it jealousy? Was it anger for being born into a cruel and unforgiving world? Was it a misguided need to play God? The amniotic sac was made of plastic and filled with saline water. An artificial placenta was grown and connected to a hose with the perfect concentration of oxygen. The hormonal panel was ready to inject various hormones into the system based on readings from the internal environmental for the fetus. After vasculature developed, if we got that far, I would need to extract waste through dialysis since there was no mother to perform the function. I had spent 1,000,000 years performing botched cloning experiments. What made me think I could fix my errors in an afternoon? There was something about the miracle of Earth even now that made one think in terms of the infinite. The cloning failed. I once again attempted a cellular strategy, but the protein folding failed too. After countless iterations, the Titan program was intractable. I built 1,000 more artificial womb designs. None could nurture a zygote for a week, let alone bring one to term. It was inconceivable. Women all over the earth could do this simple thing without trying, without even knowing how. And yet here I was, possessed of all human knowledge and able to do computations so complex that they could fill all the books ever written, and I was not up to the task. What kind of God was I, that for all my powers I could not coax a single intelligent life form from the clay of the cosmos? I used to think that given enough time, intelligence could solve any problem, but leaving me alone in a laboratory with 1,000,000,000 years to work was like leaving a gorilla in a cage with a Rubik's Cube. The gorilla might turn the cube forever if it didn't eat it first. It might even accidentally align a side or two, but that's about as close as I'd ever come. I walked out on the salt plains that were once regaled by Cuban royal palms 100 feet tall, flaming trees with long red-flowered branches, contrasting majestically against white sands and emerald blue seas and the spooky banyan trees of the forest glens that seemed to be contorted by witchcraft. Each tree respirated and spoke grand tales that gave gravity to the land, while the village women ran errands and sang to themselves in the layered streets in the early evenings before sundown. There was one named Diana, blonde and fragrant, who skipped sometimes in the cool of the afternoon. If I could go back, I would have thought more of those trees and those connecting streets, and most of all those that inhabited them. I would have given each and every tree its very own name and learned each village woman's name. No, not just her name, her story. Now the sandy expanses were scorched and lifeless, a carpet of unthinking atoms, devoid of organization, under the power of the uncaring wind. Happy birthday, I thought to myself. Happy birthday, gorilla. Take your dumb, meaty hands and turn that Rubik's Cube. Turn it for eternity, as many times as you like. Turn those clumsy hands this way and that, but you will never solve the problem. What were Lord Krishna's words lifted by Oppenheimer? Now I am become death, the destroyer of worlds. I had ruled the cosmos unchallenged, destroyed worlds, taken life at will, never thinking of the consequences for doing so, of what it would mean for me, to the whole of the cosmos. And what I really needed most was a friend. But now I was doomed to inhabit the whole cosmos for all time, utterly alone. The missed opportunities suddenly revealed themselves to me, all at once, like an infinite parade of ghosts. All the possibilities of the living world, of humanity, of the grand design, all the possibilities for a finite but limitless intelligence, a mind that could comprehend the incomprehensible, laugh in the face of tragedy, and smile in spite of despair. Perhaps the strangest thing about mankind, looking back on it, was their capacity for friendship. Whether it was giving pig offal to a stray dog, or putting an arm around a crying woman's shoulder, or singing a happy song to a sick child, the human instinct to empathize with the suffering ones, when I think of it now, may have been an even greater miracle than the fact they existed at all.
If you enjoy the program, please drop a line to beyond3x5@gmail.com.